This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Voters in Munster and Lake Station voted in favor of requests from their school districts to allow for tax increases. But East Chicago's school tax referendum failed to pass. The unofficial final count from the Lake County Board of Elections last night showed that Munster voters supported both increases for a more than $48 million capital projects plan aimed at repairs and technology improvements, and a separate request for tax hikes to raise about $3 million a year for operating expenses. 68% of Munster residents who came to the polls voted yes to both referendum questions. Superintendent Jeffrey Hendricks is very pleased that Munster residents supported the requests.
We are absolutely ecstatic about our community coming out and supporting us and being able to pass these two referenda. It just shows how much our community cares about our students and our schools and the value they put on education and helping us to continue to provide the academically best programs for our schools. So we are just so appreciative of our community and all the volunteers and the supporters who came out over the last several weeks to help us push this through and get it passed for both our capital and our operating referenda. So we're just really excited about this, and we're looking forward to the next several years of really doing some really great things for our kids.
Lake Station voters approved tax increases to raise about $6 million a year for school operating expenses by a 54% vote. School officials said they may have to make some very difficult decisions if the referendum had failed. Here's Lake Station School Superintendent Thomas Cripp-Liver.
Obviously, we are just thrilled to death. We are very excited for our children and our students of Lake Station Community Schools, who really are the winners of the referendum that our Lake Station community and our Lake Station voters voted in last night. So it's quite a victory for our students, and they're the winners, and we're very, very excited about it.
Tell us about the organization that you and your colleagues there at the Lake Station School office put together to be able to talk with residents, and you've had opportunities, of course, in public forums before the vote, on trying to, I guess you could say, even selling the idea of asking for the increase and why there's so many things that were at stake if the increase didn't go through.
Well, this was a team effort from all levels, starting with our Board of School Trustees, who understood and realized the financial predicament that Lake Station Community Schools, but all public schools in the state of Indiana are in, and their courage to support the referendum and leading us and helping us move forward with its successful outcome that we saw last night. But this was really a team effort, Chris. It was from Board of School Trustees, administration, our teachers, our support staff, community, students, all of us working together as a team, focused on one goal and moving in that direction to achieve that goal. That's what really made this a success. And we had opportunities to speak to our Chamber of Commerce. We had opportunities to speak to our precinct committee men and women, our city council, our mayor. We talked to our parent-teacher organizations at all of our schools. We had night out with the superintendent. We had three of those, basically town hall meetings, or community members could come in to our school and meet with me and meet with our chief financial officer, Eric Kurtz, who did an outstanding job presenting the information to our community in ways in which all of us could understand the financial predicament that we are in and what we are facing and what we have to do to meet that financial challenge. So it was a lot of people, a lot of effort, a lot of hard work that made this possible for us in Lake Station last night.
Now, I know that there's still a lot of work ahead. I understand, of course, that nothing official has really, I guess, been said concerning Polk Elementary School, although I know that it was voiced at one time during all of the discussions up to the referendum that it may possibly be that if it didn't pass, that something may have to be done with the school itself. There was also concern about school bus transportation, and I understand, too, that you actually kind of put the state on notice, saying that if we don't get this referendum through, if we are not successful, that we may have to stop the buses. Because not because we want to, but because we can't afford to run them. And I'm sure there are probably still some questions you're going to have to address, even though that you know that the levies have been increases have been approved.
Yes, that's exactly right, Chris. We did have to put the state of Indiana, the Department of Education, on notice that on January 1st, 2020, we would have to stop bus transportation service for our students simply because of funding. With the successful referendum last night, this certainly gives us options that we didn't have prior to the referendum passing, so we are looking forward to maintaining our transportation for our students. This is something the Board of School Trustees did not want to eliminate, nor did I and any of us in our organization want to eliminate, and this certainly gives us the advantage in order to maintain our bus transportation for our students. Polk Elementary School is still under consideration. Definite decision to close Polk School has not been made, or the final decision to keep it open has not been made. But with the successful referendum last night, it gives us options and opportunities that we can now take a look at that, again, prior to last night's successful referendum, we simply didn't have. In other words, if the referendum did fail last night, Polk School was definitely going to have to close. But this success, we now have some options to look at.
And you probably would probably have to make some very hard decisions in some other cases, too, I imagine, if that were the case. But luckily not. And it gives you an opportunity, as you say, to step back and take a look at things and know that that you have these opportunities to be able to make improvements and still keep the Lake Station Community Schools going.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As we've been telling our community all along, we have to attack our financial situation by two fronts. One, we have to increase revenue, i.e. being the referendum and its success, and also continue to cut and deal with cost-cutting measures in our school district and always look to where we can cut our costs but yet maintain the high quality of standards we expect from our vendors and that we deal with and all the other organizations that we deal with to maintain our school district. So it's a twofold. We need to increase revenue through the referendum, but yet we also need to continue to cut our costs and to look at cost-cutting measures. And we will continue to do that, even with the successful referendum and as we move forward into the next school year and beyond. We are always going to be looking at how can we be more efficient and more effective in utilizing our taxpayer dollars.
78% of the East Chicago residents who came out to vote yesterday rejected the school tax increase to cover education programs, staff salaries and benefits, and other general fund expenses. Superintendent Paige McNulty issued a statement after the defeat. Just 561 voters had favored the referendum in East Chicago compared to the 2010 who opposed it, according to the unofficial totals. Dr. McNulty said, quote, "Tomorrow begins a new day for our students and our community. We believe and have faith in the future of our schools and all care deeply about our kids and their futures. We will do what educators do best, make sure that our kids are safe, are nurtured, and that we continue to prepare them for the educational, employment, and public service opportunities of the future." She went on to say that tonight's loss means we will have to do more with less while meeting those and other challenges. Only about 7,700 people came out to vote on Tuesday in East Chicago, Lake Station, and Munster. Lake County Elections Board Executive Director Michelle Fayman told us that she's disappointed at the turnout, but she says the superintendents take a different view.
The school corporations are really working towards those that are going to be in favor of it, and those are the target audience. And so when they're seeing a small turnout, they're anticipating that only those individuals that they've contacted and worked on are the ones that come out, and not the masses that come out for your regular candidates, example, presidential election and so forth.
Fayman says that there may be more local school districts asking their voters for tax increases later this year. One of them is Hobart. The Gary Community School Board is reportedly planning to vote on Monday to ask for another special election. The Gary School Board failed to get support from its residents through a similar referendum not long ago. Fayman says that going back to Gary voters right now is not a good idea, since the state-appointed emergency manager and the fiscal management board to be set up are just about to take over the Gary Community School Corporation's finances.
Instead of going out and spending, say, roughly $80,000 or $100,000 to conduct election, I think this new agency will want to review all the documents, review all the records, find out if there's other ways to cut costs before we go out and spend $80,000 to $100,000 on a special election. So I think they're going to want to review a lot of the data now that has passed.
But that's not likely to be the case with Hobart, because we know that Hobart's already have had a number of public sessions talking about this, explaining the situation, and the superintendent trying to let them know, said, don't worry, the impact of this is not going to hit you until 2020. You know, you'll see the impact eventually, but it's not going to come if you vote on this, say, in November, you're not going to see big increases in your property tax.
Well, right now we're paying 2016 taxes payable 2017. So the same thing will hold true for if we have a 2017 tax, especially at the end of the year, really your 2017 year will already be over. It'll be more effective for 2018, right, payable 2019. So you're not going to see that big increase for like a community that will do it in the November election.
Yeah.
Those are just things that we've heard so far. Whether they're doing or not, the deadline for them to certify it to our office will be August 1st for anyone wanting to do it for the November election. So that is the deadline. Of course, they have to go through the DLGF, which is the Department of Local Government Finance, to get the question approved and to make sure they meet all the criteria and so forth. Right now, it appears that they're just doing education for the voters to let them know that this is what we're looking at, maybe weighing some other options and just making sure that, you know, before we do go out and spend this large amount of money, that we know that we've exhausted all other avenues.
Indiana University's Center for Evaluation and Education Policy keeps statistics on the number of referendum votes in the state. It says that Hoosier voters have supported about 60% of the school referendums since the process began in 2008. Lake County was one of five counties in Indiana holding a special referendum vote on school funding yesterday. At the State House, the governor has gone ahead and he's finished the work of the 2017 legislative session by signing the remaining bills that were left on his desk.
Among the final bills Governor Holcomb signed into law is the measure temporarily rewriting the state's alcohol laws. The bill, a response to Ricker's convenience stores obtaining a pair of restaurant alcohol carryout permits, imposes a new requirement for carryout. And while grandfathering in almost all existing permit holders, the bill leaves Ricker's out, meaning it'll likely lose its permits next year. In a statement, Holcomb says signing that bill comes with an understanding that the state's alcohol laws must be reviewed and changed. Holcomb also made law a measure legalizing baby boxes in hospitals, while also sanctioning the state's two existing devices, both of which are in firehouses. The boxes are meant to provide people with more anonymity when dropping off unwanted newborns, but the bill imposes few safety regulations, and the Department of Child Services had balked at the legislation during session. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
In a statement, Ricker's owner Jay Ricker says that while he thinks the alcohol bill should have been vetoed, he's heartened that the governor had acknowledged the need for a common-sense review of Indiana's alcohol laws. Indiana Attorney General Curtis Hill is appealing the federal ruling against a state law that requires women to wait at least 18 hours between an ultrasound exam and an abortion. 2016 law required an 18-hour period between the two procedures. Few Indiana clinics perform abortions, so that law would require many Hoosier women to make two long trips instead of one. Planned Parenthood and the American Civil Liberties Union sued, and a federal court judge recently ruled in their favor. ACLU of Indiana Legal Director Ken Falk says they're hopeful that they'll prevail in the appeal as well.
I think that the district court judge's decision is sound, and we'll await the briefing and the argument and then the decision in the Court of Appeals.
The Indiana Right to Life is applauding the appeal, saying in a statement that Attorney General Hill is defending what they call the state's common-sense ultrasound law. Separate parts of last year's abortion law, provisions banning abortions performed because of the fetus's characteristics and a potential disability and requiring medical facilities to bury or cremate fetal remains, was halted by a previous court ruling, and they have not been appealed. Valparaiso University's School of Business and a College of Engineering are partnering to be able to boost entrepreneurship in Northwest Indiana. The Innovation Hub, as it is being called, is being dedicated on September 29th. It's supported by a more than $1 million gift from the estate of a former Miller Brewing Company account director, and it will be located in a former First Source Bank branch on the north edge of campus that was donated to Valpro by Task Force Tips Incorporated CEO Stuart McMillan in honor of his father. Valparaiso College of Engineering Dean Eric Johnson told Inside Indiana Business recently that entrepreneurial skills are vitally important to students.
We tell our students, as a baseline, you should be technically competent. But in today's world, that's not going to be enough. You're going to have these threads of expertise in other areas to really solve the world's problems today. And that might, and one of those threads, I think, is innovation and entrepreneurship. And so how can we not give our students just a simple one-off project that they get, you know, their junior year, but how can we actually integrate different activities and programs throughout their 4 years at the university? And I will say that both Dean Brzezinski and myself have really not only focused on engineering and business, but we want this to be throughout all the university. I know there's a lot of talk about what is the value of a liberal arts degree, And I believe that there's a significant value with that, but also that we can actually make it more valuable if we can help those history majors, those art or music majors, see that if they're entrepreneurial, they can think about how they can market themselves or market what they want to do in their area and be very successful.
The benefactor of the Innovation Hub, Deb Tesser Spancraft, had graduated from Valparaiso University in 1971, went to work at Miller Brewing, worked there for 20 years, retiring in 1995. The university says that the Innovation Hub will combine the academic and real worlds, and Dean Johnson says that the facility's impact will spread beyond the campus.
We've spoken quite a bit with the Valparaiso Economic Development Corporation here in the city and talked to them about the value that this hub would bring to the community and what they were looking for also. And so they've actually connected us with a couple of other key players in the area that we can talk with to see how what we're doing is not really in competition with them, but what we're doing will kind of collaborate with what they're trying to do. There is a very large Purdue presence up here, especially with their research centers, and our idea is to, again, kind of complement that, not so much compete with that.
Valparaiso University Business School Dean James Brzezinski says that the Innovation Hub at McMillan Hall will act as a catalyst for nurturing new ideas from every college on campus by injecting an entrepreneurial vigor in both academic and life pursuits. And President of Valparaiso University, Mark Heckler, says this will all prepare students better for success in a dynamically changing world that Heckler says needs some innovative thinking and strong moral character. A new edition of Oddball Indiana, a guide to 350 really strange places, now available, and its author, Jerome Poland, told us recently about some of the places here in Northwest Indiana. And Jerome says that the second edition of his book gave him a chance to talk about some new places that he found and to talk about some places that no longer exist.
Over time, a lot of these places are very small. They might have two or three visitors a day. And some of them burn to the ground or someone moves away. And the more I learned about what had happened to the old sites, it needed a refresher. And the first book did very well, people had contacted me and gave me ideas about new sites to go see. Mm-hmm. So it expanded from there.
I know that one of the places that had been in the first edition that is not in the second, but you note the fact that it is already gone, is here in Northwest Indiana, the Oz Museum in Chesterton.
Right.
That was pretty sad learning when you learned that one's had disappeared already.
Absolutely. But since then, they added a Orville Redenbacher statue
That's
in Chesterton.
Right.
It was replaced in a different location.
Let's take a look at some of the places. We'll start out first here in Lake County. One of the places that many people know about, it's been certainly the topic of trips and tours for a long, long, long time, has been the Marktown neighborhood in East Chicago. What got you the idea to check that out? Did somebody tell you about that ahead of time and say, you got to try and drive through this area?
Yes, it's sort of difficult to find because it's sort of wedged between the steel mills and some of the refineries there, and Marktown was a community that was devised by Howard Van Doren Shaw, and it was based on European architecture. But it wasn't exactly very practical because the streets are so narrow that people have to park their cars on the street. So my entry about this is, park on the sidewalk and walk in the street. It's a very strange looking place. It's a little bit, long in the tooth, run down a bit. I had heard that they were possibly going to be expanding a refinery, when I went there and visited, for the second edition, still there.
I think that maybe the talk has just gone around the neighborhood. I'm sure the BP refinery would still like to claim some of the property, and I know it's getting dangerously close to the residents, which is one reason I think why they wanted to get if they do take over to, mm-hmm. to use it as expansion area for the refinery, they'd ask people to move out just for safety's sake, I would
right.
imagine. So,
but it looks like an old European village when you're driving through there, a little
it's very
rundown.
Neat. The first time I think I ever heard about this notoriety was something that was in a Ripley's Believe It or Not.
Oh, okay.
Column that when it's actually his somebody or he maybe he Mr. Ripley drew a little depiction of what some of the streets in Marktown were like. It's very interesting to check out. The book talks about all kinds of things, and you have to take a look at the whole book to get the real feel. Even if you just focus in on the northern Indiana part of the book,
there's a lot in here about cows, and that's not only about the new version of cows, so to speak, there at Fair Oaks Farm south of us here off I-65, but also some cows that have been hanging around for a long time. Tell us about the cows.
Well, every time that I ran across a fiberglass cow in the state, I added it to a list. So there's actually a list of, I think, about a dozen different fiberglass cows that you can find. I think there's one on top of Swiatek's
Meat. Yes, right. That's the place that's on Broadway in Merrillville. That's one you see there right on top of there. In fact, it's perched right next to their sign where they advertise the specials.
Right.
That's one place, too. And I know there's another one, I guess, the Howard and Sons Meat Market on Ridge Road.
Okay,
Munster is another place too. That's another great place.
And as you're heading down in south on 65, mm-hmm. You'll see quite a few of them leading to Fair Oaks Farms.
Tell us, if you will, about some of the spots in Gary that you saw that were interesting enough that ought to be mentioned in the book, Oddball, Indiana.
Well, of course, there are the Michael Jackson sites from the Michael Jackson family. When the book first came out, there was no marker at the Jackson family house, which is on Jackson Street, but not named after the Jackson family. Now they have a large memorial that's out in front of this house, and you can also visit where the family went to the Jehovah Witnesses Kingdom Hall and the ruins of the old Lucky Lounge.
In Valparaiso, there are quite a few spots there that are noted in the book as well. We mentioned just one at the beginning of our conversation, the Orville Redenbacher statue. Mm-hmm. Who tipped you off to that?
That one actually was in the news. One of the things that I do, I have a file for every state in the union because I'm constantly putting out new books. So every time I hear some strange news, I will clip out the article or jot a note to myself and I'll stick it in the I'll stick it in the envelope or the file folder for each one. And when the Orville Redenbacher statue was erected, there was actually quite a bit of news in the Chicagoland area about this statue that was put up. And now it's in the park. It's downtown.
John Dillinger, the notorious gangster, who, of course, met his fate outside a famous theater in Chicago, also known, too, for his exploits as a bank robber with his gang in Northwest Indiana and other places as well, has a special section in this book. Tell us about the Diapers to Death tour, as you kind of put it in the book.
Right. He was born in Indianapolis, and so I trace everything from his birth in Indianapolis, when he was growing up in Mooresville, Indiana, which is southwest of Indianapolis, where he committed his first crime and ended up in the Pendleton facility. He asked to be transferred to the Michigan City facility because they had a baseball team. Mm-hmm. And that's where he met all the gang members that would become known as the Terror Gang, doing bank robberies in the 1930s. I try to include as many confirmed Dillinger heists that took place within the borders of Indiana in the book as possible. And of course, I also include the famous escape that he made from the Lake County Jail in Crown Point. Mm-hmm. And that is now open for tours. If you go to their website, you can find out the times, and they're actually open. And then just in the courthouse across the street, they have the Dillinger collection, where you can see the wooden gun and you can see the wicker basket where he was put in the morgue in Chicago and the Cook County morgue after he was shot outside the Biograph Theater.
Oddball, Indiana, A Guide to 350 Really Strange Places is available now from Chicago Review Press. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. More than 2,000 years ago, Aristotle remarked, "Every art, every inquiry, and every action is thought to aim at some good, and for this reason the good has rightly been declared to be that at which all things aim." Is activism still needed in the age of infotech? Does media play a role in its impact? Well, that's the topic for this Counterpoint conversation with Gerard McClendon and his guests, Indiana University Northwest Professor Eve Botondo and Sheila Garland of National Nurses United.
Heavy topic. We've got a brand new president that's going to be taking office. We've got social media that's just on fire right now. Activism and civil rights organizations have become awake again, and we're seeing that activism and communication is very important to a person's survival or to people's survival. So let's first start by asking the question, what's more important, the medium or the movement, the communication or the cause when it comes to activism? Either of you want to start us off here today?
Well, you know, I don't think you can have a movement without both. Because without the ability to communicate what the purpose of the cause is, it's really hard to build for a movement, I think, number one. Number two, I think, you know, when you talk about activism in and of itself as an entity that stands alone, it's kind of sort of difficult to imagine that in my world. Activism without a level of consciousness is just activity that really doesn't lead anywhere. So, but if you have a coherent sort of idea or an agenda or a program about where you want to go, then you're going to integrate all aspects of, you know, developing consciousness, communication, how do you use the various communication tools at our disposal. You know, every age, you had different tools of communication. Times ago, you know, you stand on a street corner and do the soapbox. Now we do, you know, Twitter and Facebook, so.
Good, and I'm glad you started us off there, because I'm going to come to you, Dr. Batanda. The importance of communicating a message and why the communicator, regardless of the medium you use, why the communicator and what he or she says is so important. Is there a more influential way of communicating a message, whether it's activism, whether it's propaganda, whether it's advertising? What are the tools that a communicator can use to activate a point of view?
I'll go for a very strange example. Let's go to Mount Sinai. Tablets, Moses, stone, very old mode of communication. But why does this message continue? It was because of the personal relationships and networks established between Moses and the Jewish people. That's how the message continues. What we realize, what social media helps us realize, what I've learned as a teacher, is that these personal networks are the ways that we get our messages out. It's affinity, it's desire, it's love. And that love connected to particular consciousness, which can also be something very, it can turn violent. Yeah. Remember that the voice of Hitler helped inspire lots of people. And the fact that his voice was amplified was key to getting that message out and inspiring many different people towards a decision that killed many people and put into place infrastructures for that killing.
So the communication, of course, is the thing that is used to drive a point forward, to drive activism forward, but it seems to be an ethics issue that comes into play as well. There's a morality play that we have here. And let's talk, I'm glad you opened that up in terms of the tablets, in terms of communication, because when we look at National Nurses United, nurses go through hell throughout the course of a day, all right? Sometimes people on the outside say, oh, nurses make a lot of money. They can deal with it. You know, nurses deal with some circumstances that can become hazardous at times, but they're compensated well. Why is there a need for activism or a labor union when it comes to nurses?
Well, primarily because you want to protect your patients. When you silence the nurse's voice at the bedside, that means that your patient is in greater harm. So unionized nurses who have collective bargaining agreements have the ability to negotiate how they can better protect and advocate for the patient. If you don't have that ability, if your voice is silenced as a registered bedside nurse, then the kind of things that we see happening to patients in hospitals that are non-union, even hospitals that are unionized, where they, you know, where the hospital industry, the healthcare industry, is always trying to maximize its profit. It's always trying to reach its bottom line. Because they're financial centers, right? You have, you know, they're leveraging their stock so they can constantly buy, enrich the CEO. They starve out, you know, what happens at the bedside in terms of supplies, you know, equipment, staff. You know, all those things are cut for the sake of profit.
So this is where the activism starts then. It starts with the nurse trying to do the best job they can for the patient. But the nurse has to be taken care of as well, or else there'd be no labor union for nurses. So let's get right into that issue. Besides the patient, how do we need to activate to take care of nurses?
So, I mean, I think that's a really interesting question, because I think everything in society is connected. And I think that there are processes that that are underway that have historical antecedents, mm-hmm. and that serve a purpose for those that rule versus those that have no power. So it really is a power play about who has the power and what is it that you do in order to maintain that power, expand that power, and create the sort of influences in society at large in order for your ideas to grab hold and to become the centerpiece of any sort of historical period that we're living in. You have to put it within its context. If you go back to the advent of religion, what purpose did it serve for when you had the ability to extract a bit of surplus? Mm-hmm. That meant that you had a certain group of people that could engage in leisure. So when you have the ability to engage in leisure, you're not so ground down by work, you can sort of think about and do things that you would not have ordinarily been able to do if you were out there grubbing and, you know.
Yeah. Aristotle, Plato, Socrates exactly. talked exactly. about leisure right. and talked about the ability to ponder.
Exactly.
Which is some people look at it as a waste of time, but unless you can ponder, you can't think deeply about a specific subject. I saw your hand,
so
doctor.
To go with what Sheila's saying, the activism, nurses need unions and they need a voice because they need a messaging system, right? They need someone, they need to come together and work together to get their message out about care to patients because it's already a part of the hospital infrastructure to have public relations, to have relationships with newspapers, and to traditionally be the ones who are sourced when people have a question. When they ask mm-hmm. a question about healthcare, they don't ask the nurses.
Do professors need a union?
Absolutely.
Does every worker in the United States need a union?
Absolutely.
Or if I'm the owner of a business and I say, I frown upon unions, right to work. You work for these wages right. or else.
Well, let's,
and if you don't want to work for these wages, I'm not going to give you a voice. You can work elsewhere. Talk to me.
So listen, every single industry, they're organized. They collectivize their power. They collectivize their ability to leverage what they need in terms of politics, in terms of, you know, getting votes, paying off our elected officials. So there is collectivized power when you go up the hierarchy. However, the message to the masses is that you need to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps.
Oh.
You have to go at it individually. You have to go at it. So in terms of communicating a message, because this is inherent, right? This is inherent in the system that we live under. The kind of messaging that we get really kind of predicate how we then react in our society at large. So for those workers who think that they're going to emulate what the wealthy people do, mm-hmm. that all I have to do is just make money on my own, they don't see the interconnectedness between how in those circles they work together. They say, well, you know, I have an idea. Let's go after this.
So
let's figure out how to buy you
out. So the voice of the powerful is more powerful than the voice of the weak?
I disagree that's yeah. true. But I also think it's foolhardy to not take into consideration how power is vetted and expanded out into the society at large and who has control of it. Working people do have control. That's why you have unions, we have other worker organizations and other community groups and those sorts of things that give us the ability to articulate our demands, right?
But there has to be solidarity.
Well, look, no one who believes in this, like, you know, the student that graduates from my university that's not union, right, but they've taken my courses and we've discussed all sorts of realms about, like, what's possible when you join together to communicate. If they believe, like, it's really most important that I go out there and fight for my point of view, they are not a dupe, first of all. They
okay.
are not a dupe for believing in that. However, it's really important that we take a moment to stop and pause and think about what Sheila's saying. There is collective action happening. Maybe, you know, each CEO isn't in together talking about it, mm-hmm. but there are ways that people get used to getting work done.
Mm-hmm.
And those ways are not accessible to the average nurse or the average professor, but when we join together, we can make a joyful noise.
Yeah.
Could I talk for a moment about why I went to Dakota Access.
Hold on tight to that because I may have to wait to the next segment for that, but we'll definitely open up with that. I do want to ask you this before we leave, though. Do you think that unions should always exist?
So, you know.
Make it quick.
Okay, so from my perspective,
yes or no?
Yes, I think unions should exist.
What about you?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Okay.
More.
Okay. Hey, you know what? It's getting heated. Is activism still needed in the age of infotech? How is the voice of reason communicated and heard in a world of competing interests? I've got Dr. E. Batondo from IUN and Sheila Garland from National Nurses United. Thanks for staying with us for the second half. Man, I got Nurses United, I got professors in the mix, and now we could talk about the Dakota Pipeline. Man, you talk about activism meeting business in a severe way. Talk to us. You had some access to the Dakota situation.
Well, I had access because I'm a public professor at a university studying media and how media matter in our world. And I had students who follow me on Facebook saying, after taking classes with me, that, hey, let's check in at Standing Rock. And if we check in at Standing Rock, that will mean anybody that's there won't actually be surveilled by the police. Now, I taught classes about this. Likely, the police aren't probably figuring out how to do the check-in thing, but the fact that people believed in it, and all these folks checked in for a myriad of reasons, I wanted to go and find out what was actually happening.
What was actually happening?
Well,
we kind of know the outcome, but what was actually happening? What was on the ground?
Well, when you get in, before you're able to go into any of the camps, you get an orientation and you agree to these simple rules. No drugs, no alcohol, no weapons, and you are a guest of the Sioux people. You're not there for whatever you thought you were coming there for.
You're not there for recreation. You're not there for a photo op. You're there to benefit and to try to cohabitate and to make sure that the cause gets drawn forth and the people are respected.
So yeah, we had nurses on the ground in Standing Rock. Mm-hmm. So we worked with medic tents and providing health care, particularly when the clashes became violent on the part of the state. Mm. So we were actually working with and taking care of those folks that had been injured, making sure people to get in frostbite, just very basic, kind of health care needs. And so National Nurses United has stood extraordinarily strong in our solidarity with what was happening there. And like the professor is saying, there were certain rules. You didn't go in there with your own agenda. So the importance of communicating what was at stake. This was about the power of this government and the corporations that are seeking to essentially destroy, our water supplies, soil, sacred sites.
Manifest destiny.
I mean, it's worse than manifest destiny because it's that in the age of technology.
So let's talk about this, because activism had to take place there, didn't it? Pretty obvious.
Well, it could have
gone terribly wrong. And so what was the importance of communicating the message and people using social media to get the message out? If you remember, the first few weeks, very few people in the United States were even interested because it wasn't getting the top-notch media coverage. All of a sudden, people started using Twitter, people started using Facebook Live, and then you started to see things pop.
Well, it's all about sourcing. Understand that the media are trying to get the message out, and they want to go for the sources that are official and tested. So you go to government sources, you go to the sheriff. You don't go to the nurses, you don't go to the nurses union, and you don't go to professors who happen to be driving in their Jeep across country to go find out what's happening. And so because of that sourcing, then that's the only story that gets told. That's why I got in my Jeep and left. It was important as an educator that I knew. I felt it was ethically responsible, and that's why so many people went there. Nurses taking time off and getting support from wherever they were to go and help take care of folks, because that story was not getting told. But as more and more people showed up, more and more people put out their own messages, more and more people insisted that their voice get heard.
But does
the sourcing had to change.
Good. So let's look at the counterpoint.
Okay.
You dig the pipeline. Do you benefit more? Do you benefit society more by building the pipeline, manifest destiny, or are the few greater than the many?
You know, to me, that's kind of the wrong question. To me, the question is, you know, what is the impact of digging for fossil fuels?
What's the impact of us having fluorocarbons and people driving cars every day? We still drive cars, we're hurting portions of society.
Right.
So do you think that activism sometimes takes on an approach that is individual and not collective? Because the reason why I got to give you the counterpoint is because there are things that we all consume in society that are bad and wrong for others, but we justify them because they're good for me.
So, I mean, taking that premise, we're always going to end up at a dead end when you take that premise.
The reason
why I say that is because the kinds of commodities that are available to us are not necessarily in our control for production. Mm-hmm. They're the commodities that really benefit a few. So if the majority of people are able to talk about what kind of commodities or what do we need in order to secure ourselves, the conversation is very different. I've been working out in in East Chicago as well as on the southeast side of Chicago around the lead and the petcoke issue.
These are
the kind of issues that affect people directly in terms of our health, in terms of the community, just our ability to live without the violence of digging up and harming us on a regular and a daily, our air and whatever. So I think the question has to be a lot different.
I grew up in Hammond. I spent a lot of my time in East Chicago, West Calumet. A lot of my friends were there. What was interesting about West Calumet, there seemed to be an exorbitant amount of cancer cases in that area. Some close friends of mine died in their 30s. They went to East Chicago, Chicago Roosevelt at the time. Late 20s, early 30s, right. Dying of cancer, you know.
The health toll of our demand, and when I say our, I'm talking about the corporate demand for fossil fuels and for dirty technology is killing us.
So there needs to be activism for that.
So not just activism, but it has to be who is going to lead that political demand, because activism activity, as I said earlier, by itself doesn't get you anywhere.
But if the politician doesn't lead that particular movement, do we need activists outside of political figures to push them? Lyndon B. Johnson said it best, right? He said, Martin Luther King, make me do it. Make me sign the Civil Rights Bill. So even though we live in this world where we think everyone should be ethical, sometimes you have to have some pushback from someone saying, you're wrong, and we're going to show you and the world that you're wrong. Now do something about it.
What we need is we need to listen to Sheila's advice. You have to ask the right questions. You cannot sit there and look at Lyndon B. Johnson or Martin Luther King or the latest politician or whoever's behind the mic as the activist. You need to learn how to ask good questions. Don't follow the distracting line. So let's focus here on what's going on with Dakota Access Pipeline. Don't get thrown off onto all the different ways that a Twitter-based form of communication will send you, because it will send you to panic and fear.
Yeah.
Go away from that. Panic and fear disrupts our ability to stop, pause, and think carefully about what's going on.
Activism, what's more important, boots on the ground or air attack with media?
Both.
Yeah.
Maybe both.
Even though with Dakota Access, we saw how important the internet was, we saw how important social media was, but the people still had to go there. You still had to get in the car and go there.
Let me give a detail, just a little detail about how media work over at the Standing Rock Ocheti-Sakowin camp. You're not allowed to take pictures. This is both cultural and a respect issue. Now, you see a lot of pictures. Those people have gotten, they've shown responsibility enough to be able to take pictures. And so when I came there, as someone that didn't know nothing about nothing, I came there with a camera and I didn't take pictures. I didn't publish pictures from inside the camp. I only went to where I was allowed to go. So actually, to understand what was happening, people who were trained, so before you go out in a direct action, you have to be trained on camp. And if you're trained to be one of the documenting folks, the media people in the group, then you take pictures. And that's so important because the camera, from another angle, helps shed light on that different facet of what's going on.
Yeah, that's true. The camera does shed light.
And I will say that every struggle has its own processes and its own sort of rules. What defined the struggles around civil rights or around women's liberation or LGBTQ rights, around Standing Rock? Who are we going up against? And what is it that we know about who our enemy is? Mm-hmm. Who are the people that we ally with in order to move our demand forward? Every single fight that we engage in historically in this country has been defined by the people who have built the fight, right? Because they're the ones who understand the nature of that fight. So it's kind of hard to lump everything together, given how we've organized historically in the past. Yeah. What we're lacking, I think, in the way we organize in this society and in this period, is that we lack that the breaking down of silos of independent politics. The independent politics works very, very well for the ruling class, because if I'm only going to be interested in my particular fight, that means I'm not going to reach across and join up with the next fight, because we all have a common enemy that we're fighting.
So is the common enemy ethereal, a gaseous substance, or is the common enemy concrete? So, for instance, when people say, we're going to fight against the man and shut things down on Black Friday, does that even make any sense if you're not going toward the so-called man or the so-called enemy who is direct? Who is the enemy?
Every fight is incremental.
Okay.
You have targets, you have goals. I mean, there are certain things that you do along the way. Mm-hmm. So the demand to stop the commodification of our lives by forcing us to buy at certain periods of time in order to enrich a system that doesn't give back to certain communities, be they Black or white, immigrant, documented or undocumented, LGBTQ, whatever those communities are, versus having the broader fight, right, around collectivizing all of these fights and saying, yeah, now the man is, you can sort of point your finger at the man. But I think people have to engage at a certain level in order to develop that.
I got about 20 seconds left.
The enemy can be your best buddy from grade school. How does that work? Because someone that I have a love for can become a lobbyist to try to shut down freedom of speech on the internet or try to commodify all those things that I love. But I also love that person. Yeah. This is the world that we have to accept. We've always been living in.
Yeah.
As a college professor, I get that privilege. Privilege is really the right word.
Yes.
Because I can float in between a lot of circles. I'm allowed into the elites,
yeah,
right? As well as allowed into the common day.
Counterpoint with Gerard McClendon airs on Friday nights at 8 o'clock on Lakeshore PBS. Lakeshore Public Radio's Stephen Lattimore visited the Veterans Cafe in Merrillville recently to not only sample the food, but to talk to those at the cafe who benefit from its mission of helping local veterans.
Price coleslaw.
At the Veterans Cafe and Grill in Merrillville, they are in the business of making good food that helps save veterans' lives. It's run by Bessie Hitchcock, Brian Cody, and Larry Curtis. Bessie also helps veterans at her non-for-profit, the Veterans Life-Changing Center in Gary, Indiana. At the group home, they feed and house 15 veterans. They also offer job training, counseling, and other services. Eric Scott is a Desert Storm veteran. He works here.
Well, the reason I'm there, I was employed for 10 years, and my job, they closed down due to the economy in 07. So, after then, I was, I found myself real in trying to find, permanent employment. And for years, it just wasn't panning out. I kind of lost my way. And Veteran Life Changing Services is getting me back on, my course of life.
if it were not for the group home and the Veterans Cafe, some of these people aren't sure where they would be.
To be honest with you, no telling. Yep, probably would have been riding the train somewhere back and forth to stay warm at night, or if I couldn't go anywhere else.
Where I was staying, the people that I was, where I was living, they got transferred to Florida and everything else and just couldn't find a place right away. So, I mean, being on my disability, I just can't afford anything.
People support the work that's being done here by eating here. Some of the customers are also veterans.
And it means a lot to me because I lost a lot of my buddies, you know, in the last few wars. And fortunately, somebody was looking out for me. So I know what it is to lose somebody, especially a buddy. And not just lose them, get them all blown apart and everything. That hurts.
Brian Cody is a partner here at the Veterans Cafe and Grill. He came to the Veterans Life Changing Center in need of help.
I do know for the United States alone, there's at least 52,000 homeless veterans every night that either sleep on the streets or in a shelter. Okay, as far as Northwest Indiana, I know that there are homeless veterans. I can't give you a number, but it's prevalent. Veterans are very proud, and they'll let things get. They don't like to ask for help. So a lot of times things get out of whack and they end up sleeping in their car because they couldn't pay their rent, they couldn't do this and they couldn't do that because either they didn't want to ask for help or they didn't know that there were services available for them. Our motto is helping heroes with a hand up, not a handout. One of our original goals was to develop entrepreneurs, to take veterans that maybe have no hope in their future and maybe retrain them in culinary arts or in kitchen management and maybe help them to branch out to be entrepreneurs on their own. If they take that hope that they're given and they build on it and they work at it and they fight and they push and they work hard, there's no limits.
In Maryville, Stephen Lattimore, Lakeshore Public Radio.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. Tom Maloney's here behind the microphone tomorrow for Reporter Roundtable Thursday. We look at the big stories from Northwest Indiana of the week. We hope you'll join us tomorrow on Regionally Speaking.